All right, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is, in fact, Tuesday, October 26th. Is that correct? Chem 4:21. We are actually now near the end of chapter 13. I just passed out a chapter 14 handout, although I uploaded it as well. I just want to make sure we have it in case we need it. But we're looking at I also passed out a couple handouts for those of you who are listening. One of them was called Thermodynamics Homework Handout. And I assigned question number one. I'll be assigning this kind of in slow motion over the next few days. So just as a good review for what's going on for the final, I don't want you to forget from the beginning of the semester. And then secondly, there is also a handout that's simply called Problems. It's a copy from a textbook, an out-of-print textbook. And we're going to start practicing in some of these problems. Now, I know I assign stuff in your textbook for homework. Honestly, I'm not sure how many people did all the brutal details to make it work. So we're just going to continue practice. We're going to, instead of a clicker quiz today, we're going to go through this question, one of these questions. We'll be doing that over the next few days. All right, we may have a clicker in one of these, but we're going to go on. Let's take a look at question number one, shall we? Question number one, I'll read aloud while you read along, please. You'll want to get out some paper and pen to take notes. Hydrolytic driving force. The hydrolysis of pyrophosphate to orthophosphate is important in driving forward biosynthetic reactions such as the synthesis of DNA. Now, what they're saying is this, and we'll see that today or soon, actually maybe chapter 14. ATP many times is a part of an enzyme reaction. Enzyme number one, for example, and this is product reactant A and product B, and you end up sometimes with AMP plus PPI. In other words, that you don't cleave off one at a time, you cleave off a pair. That PPI is called pyrophosphate. It's an inorganic material, but nevertheless, because of the resonance structure that exists as, it has a fairly high energy content. What can happen is this can further be broken down. This part can further be broken down by another enzyme, ENZ, to two PIs, two inorganic phosphates. So this is pyrophosphate, this is inorganic phosphate. This breakdown releases energy, or certainly releases entropy or driving force, to help this reaction, the A to B, go forward. So let's see this again. And it's hydrolysis because water's got to come in here. Okay, so it says again, the hydrolysis of pyrophosphate to orthophosphate is important in driving forward biosynthetic reactions such as the synthesis of DNA. This hydrolytic reaction, is catalyzed in E. coli by pyrophosphatase that has a mass of 120 kilodaltons and consists of six identical subunits. For this enzyme, a unit of activity is defined as the amount of enzyme that hydrolyzes 10 micromoles of pyrophosphate in 15 minutes at 37 degrees under standard assay conditions. The purified enzyme has a Vmax of 2,800 units per milligram of enzyme. Now then, the rest of the problem goes up to A. How many moles of substrate are hydrolyzed per second per milligram of enzyme when the substrate concentration is much greater than Km? Now, this problem is basically a conversion problem because you've been given all the necessary pieces of information. But let's take a look at it again. How many moles of substrate are hydrolyzed per second per milligram of enzyme when the substrate concentration is much greater than Km? Now, what's much greater than Km means is code for that the enzyme is acting at Vmax. Vmax. It's acting at Vmax. Do you remember? Remember what we did here? You've got velocity. You got substrate again. This is not inverse. You get something looks like this. Okay. This is first order. This is zeroth order. But if they measure this off in KMs, if they measure this off at KMs, if this is 1 KM and this is 2 KM and this is 2 KM, so what that means is that the substrate concentration is much greater than the original KM, which means they're operating down in this region, which means they're approaching essentially Vmax. So that's what that little code means. Operating much greater, the substrate concentration is much greater than Vmax, I mean than KM. It means it's operating at Vmax values. Now, if it was operating at if it was operating at KM, if it was operating at KM, where would this go to? Where would this point be right here? Yeah, it would be Vmax all over 2, or half Vmax. So theoretically, my graph is not that good, but you get the idea. Okay? You get the idea. So, let's review again. This hydrolytic reaction is catalyzed in E. coli by a pyrophosphatase, notice the enzyme, that has a mass of 120 kilodalton. A KD, kilodalton, is the biological equivalent of grams per mole. They many times use, methods like gel electrophoresis or centrifugation or size exclusion chromatography to calculate the relative mass. So for in biological applications, they don't have the exact mass calculated as they would for the periodic table. So they use the word Dalton as opposed to grams per mole. But it has an operational definition of grams per mole. So you have 120 kilodaltons and consists of 6 identical subunits. For this enzyme, a unit of activity is defined as the amount of enzyme that hydrolyzes 10 micromoles, now there's the moles, of pyrophosphate in 15 minutes at 37 degrees under standard assay conditions. The purified enzyme of this sample, and each sample will vary for the Vmax. The Vmax is only a constant for a particular and peculiar sample of enzyme. The KM is universal for whatever sample of enzyme you have. You know, the KM, if you have this pyrophosphatase you made in March, and you have the pyrophosphatase that you made in November, and another set of pyrophosphatase enzyme that you isolated in the next March, or this kind of thing, each one of those three different samples that you isolated would have their own peculiar Vmax. But the KM would be constant among all three samples. So the Vmax can be thought of a constant, but it's not as constant as you might think. But at any rate, what they've done here is they've said the Vmax is 2,800 units per milligram of the enzyme. How many moles of substrate are hydrolyzed per second per milligram of the enzyme? The substrate concentration is much greater than KM. All right, so what we're going to say here is what we know is how? Okay, so 2,800 units per milligram. What we've got here is they want to know how many moles of substrate are hydrolyzed per second per milligram of the enzyme. So what we do is we presume we have this. This is what I'm going to call 1A. And it's all it is just something. We know that a unit occurs in 15 minutes. Is that right? Yes. So the Vmax is 2,800 units, right? But a unit occurs in 15 minutes. We multiply that by the activity of each unit, which is, in this case, it says it's 10 micromoles in that same 15 minutes. So it's 10 times 10 to the minus 6 moles in one unit. Times, then, we want to know what it is per second. So we basically are trying to say 2,800 units, how much is that in a micromole per second? So then we multiply that by 1 minute over 60 seconds. That converts us to seconds. And we get our answer. So 2,800 units is micromoles per 15 minutes. It's micromoles per minute that we have. We convert that micromoles into moles. So it's 10 to the minus 10th moles per unit. That units cancel out. The minutes cancel out. And we end up with moles per second. Moles per second. So we cancel this out. Bing, bing. Moles. Oh, no, we don't cancel out moles. Cancel out minutes. And we get, as it turns out, 31.1 times 10 to the minus 6th mole per second. Okay. 2,800 units. Because one unit is what? A unit is the amount of enzyme that hydrolyzes 10 micromoles of pyrophosphate in 15 minutes. So one unit is 10 micromoles in 15 minutes. All right. 10 micromoles in 15 minutes. So that's where I got the 15 minutes from here. The units are listed here in moles. They wanted it in moles per second, so I had to get rid of the unit and make it into moles. Well, one unit is 10 micromoles. That's the same thing as 10 times 10 to the minus 6th moles in 15 minutes. So if you follow along, you can see how we get 31.1 times 10 to the minus 6th moles per second. You could change this and say 3.11 times 10 to the minus 5. It would be just fine. That's not a problem. Okay. Now, letter B. Again, this is just a conversion question. How many moles of active site are there in 1 milligram of enzyme? Assume that each subunit has one active site. One active site. So, all right. So, let me double check to make sure. A unit is defined as millimolar hydrolyzed in 50 minutes. The purified enzyme. Da 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 da. Okay. In 1 milligram of the enzyme, how many active sites are there? How many moles of active sites are there in 1 milligram? So, what's 1 milligram in grams? What's 1 mil? How? What would be the unit? What would be the thing? So, here we go. Now, we know that 1 milligram is the same thing as 1 times 10 to the minus 3 grams. Would you agree with that? Yes, indeed. So we're going to start off with this. We're going to say 1 times 10 to the minus 3 grams all over 1 times 1 mole all over 120,000 grams. Now, where did I get that 120,000 grams from? I'm starting off the problem right here. Okay. So, I'm saying... Okay. Here we go. Let me do it this way. All right. Let me do it this way. I shouldn't be just starting off. This is B again. We're going to say, let's see here. There is, we're starting off with 1 milligram over 1 times the fact that there's, okay, there we go. Here's the 1 milligram of the protein we're starting with. We're multiplying it by the conversion factor, 10 to the minus 3 grams all over 1 milligram. Milligrams cancel out. Where did I get the mole per 120,000 grams? Where did I get that from? Right, 120 kD is 120,000 Daltons per mole, which is grams per mole. So I reversed it so I could divide out the grams. And then let's see what else is there. Now, The question is, how many moles of active site are there? Well, each of the complete enzyme has how many subunits? Six subunits. And so we would say there are six moles of active site for every one mole of enzyme. Would you agree with that? Is that a true statement? If the enzyme had six identical units, subunits, and the enzyme was given one mole, you were given one mole of the enzyme, how many moles of the active site would you have? Six. Six moles. All right. So we cancel out milligram, milligram, gram, gram, mole, mole, and we end up with moles of active site. And when you do the mathematics of it, you get 5 times 10 to the minus 8 moles of active site. Moles of active site. Woohoo! Okay. So, we have this. What is this actually? This is Vmax, is that correct? In mole per second, correct? Is this Vmax in moles per second? Say yes. Yeah. And this is, what is this? This right here is what? Total number of active sites in that same 1 milligram. I wonder if that might be leading up to question part C. What is the turnover number of the enzyme? Compare this value with the other that's mentioned in the chapter. Let's not worry about the second part of it. What is the turnover number of the enzyme? Well, do you remember what the turnover number is? Do you remember? And if you remember, then follow. What's the equation? Turnover number equals what over what? What's the equation? What goes on the top? I think we just had it last chapter. It's also called KCAD, in case you can't remember. KCAD. Turnover number. Someone look it up for me, please. Turnover number. It's an enzyme activity. I mean, enzyme chapter. We'll waste our time while you look it up. Somebody shout it out at me. Don't be embarrassed. What is it? Yes. ET, that's right. ET, come home. Vmax all over ET, where E is the number of active sites total number of active sites. And so if your Vmax is got its velocities in moles, then guess what? The number of active sites also needs to be in what? Moles. Now, do we have the Vmax in moles? Yes. Do we have the total number of active sites in moles? Yes. Alrighty-dighty. Maybe there have been an actual point to this after all. Okay, so let's plug and let's chug. The Vmax, according to this, is what? 31.1 times 10 to the minus 6 moles. That's why I left it, moles per second all over. What's the number of active sites? 10 minus 8 moles. I do a simple calculation, and guess what number I get approximately? 622 per second. So, 622 per second. So what's the turnover number for this enzyme? That means at maximum velocity it's going to turn over 622 molecules or pyrophosphates to phosphates every second. That's why the units work out the way they do. All right, so, you know, again, this was a simple conversion. I kind of started off just pretty raw, and I, you know, you're going to have to look this over and see if it makes sense to you, but it should. And I'm giving you practice on how to look at enzyme-catalyzed reactions and some of the meaning of the terms. Again, if it's much greater than Vmax, if the substrate concentration is much, much greater than Km, that means they're operating near what? Vmax levels. All right. Excellent. How's everybody's spirits today? Doing pretty good? So, what does that mean? So, I've assigned one question for you for tomorrow. Is that correct? Number one. And I'd like for you to actually turn this in. I'll give you points for it, for turning it in, if you do it. So, I've assigned number one. I believe, Mr. Scholl, have you figured it out already yet?
The efficiency then gives you a very small number.
It does?
Well, I'm not understanding your efficiency backwards, but it means that if I use 0.2 of whatever number of calories just standing up,
right,
then I burn a ton. Like, say I use 2 calories standing up, I'm actually burning 10, right? Because you say 2% efficient, so...
Right. 2% efficiency. But I'm not sure. So what I was going to ask you to do is basically, when you figure out the total number of joules that are in that number of food calories, then you take 20% of that and apply it to trying to lift that 75 kilogram weight up as high as many flights as you can do. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And how many did you get?
I got 43 flights.
I don't think that's not what I have. At any rate, okay. That doesn't sound right. 0.3 flights?
I told you that was
wrong. Yeah, there's something. Yeah, that is. At any rate, you guys keep. Obviously, we have some difference. It'll be an interesting intellectual exercise for you to try this. Should take you about 10 minutes. Okay, and so. What we're going to do then on Wednesday, when we first come here, first thing in the morning, we will do number two. So I'm just going to assign this first one here, okay? And then we'll work on number two. So bring this stuff back tomorrow, and we'll work on number two together to make sure that we all understand how to do this. All righty then. So that's it. I wanted to show you, we're going to go on with the lecture. I was standing in line at Target, and I'd seen these little bottles here before. Yeah. You guys ever used them? What? Do you have any strange sensations? You just feel energized?
I use similar products.
Yeah. What happens? What? Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay.
High amounts of
really? Because you're drinking a lot of other fluids, or just this dehydrates you?
Just that.
Okay. Have you guys ever looked on the ingredient labels for these? Okay. I'd like for you to read. What? No. This is unused. I want you to read the percentage. Go down. Would you mind starting with niacin? Read the percent of daily value. Start with niacin right there. Can you see it nice and loud?
Niacin. 150%.
Okay.
Vitamin B6, 2,000%. Folic acid, 100%. Vitamin B12, 8,333%.
Yep, that's it. Vitamin B12 is, and he's not lying. What does it say? 8,333% of your daily value. I have never seen a nutritional label that looks like this. I paid $2.50 in amazement. I have no idea what 8,333% of vitamin B is going to do for you. But notice, how much is that? And MC is micro. MC is micro. So how much is that? It says it. Look at vitamin 12. And says it, then it gives you the actual value. 500 micrograms is 8,000%. How much vitamin B12 do you need in a day? Not much. Not much. What?
It's 100%.
Is that only 100%? Wimp.
6 micrograms.
6 micrograms, yeah. I don't know the physiological necessity of having that much vitamin B12. It's not a hormone. It's not a stimulant that I know of. There's only 3 chemical reactions in your entire body that need it. I have no idea. Oh, well. At any rate, so I brought this. I'm going to keep this. I don't know how long this is good for. If somebody needs one of these during the day, come by and I'll let you use this and I'll keep the bottle. Okay? But whatever. Okay, we got to go on, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to have a good time for the rest of the day. And please continue to read your chapters and so on. Okay. Fascinating stuff here. Where do we end up with? Where do we end up? On slide number 6? Have we finished slide number 6? Have we started slide number 6? We just basically got started in it. Is that correct? All right, so this is known as the RAS cascade. It begins with this some sort of protein growth factor. Again, the RTK stands for what? What does RTK stand for? Exactly. When I say RTK, I want you to immediately respond with receptor tyrosine kinase. Okay? Now then, the interior units, when they dimerize, autophosphorylate each other. What amino acid do they phosphorylate? Oh, really? Tyrosine? And what's the one-letter designation for tyrosine? Why? So they put a big old phosphate right there. Can you... the mind begins to boggle at the importance of putting a phosphate group on a tyrosine. It's got to be the right tyrosine, but that begins a cascade of enormous power and complexity to drive a cell from one stage of life to another, virtually. Now, so let's go ahead. Phosphate receptors are bound to SH. So what this means is, what I mean by phosphated receptors is, I'm presuming the protein growth factor has already initiated the autophosphorylation of each other's dimer monomer segments. So you got a phosphate here and a phosphate here. Those phosphates, tyrosine phosphates, are attacked or attached by something, a protein that is repeated over and over and over. It's called an SH2 domain. So an SH2 domain is a cassette, a repeating unit or structure that the body uses to bind a phosphated tyrosine. SH2 remains on the GRB2-SEM5 protein. Now, the GRB2-SEM5 protein illustrates an interesting issue that you face as biologists and biochemists. That the researchers who are working on these particular pathways use different species. Some use yeast, some use E. coli, some use C. elegans. And while they may find the exact same protein doing the exact same thing in a particular pathway, because it's in a different species and because it's a different research group, they don't name it the same. And so you end up having this, if you almost have to become an expert in a particular pathway to be able to pick apart all the different literature, because each species has its own name for a particular enzyme. So this is illustrated here. GRB2 is the yeast enzyme, and SEM5 is that same enzyme or protein in C. elegans, or whatever the book says. Well, fortunately enough, they give us that. They allow us this. This is unusual to have two names in one. But at any rate, so that protein, which contains that SH2 domain, also contains another two other domains called SH3 domains. These, again, are domains that are designed to be used over and over in different applications. These domains then match the domains that exist on this SOS protein. This SOS protein is classified as a GEF, which stands for guanine exchange factor, that stimulates the release of GDP from the inactive RAS protein, which exchanges that with a GTP, making the RAS active. Okay, so let's stop here. So, the RAS protein, an enzyme, is interesting in the fact that it has a GDP, GDAV phosphate binding site. But when the GDAV phosphate is there, it's inactive. The RAS protein becomes active when that GDAV protein is replaced by a GTP. The enzyme that helps do that is called SOS, S-O-S. So, here we go. So, this SOS stimulates the release of the GDP from the inactive RAS protein, which exchanges that with a GDP making the RAS active. The RAS protein has a slow GTPase activity made more active, probably made is a better term, made more active by the presence of gaps or GTPase activating proteins. The active RAS GTP complex begins the RAS signaling cascade. Okay, so here's what's happening in this. You're creating a second messenger system using the enzyme cascade. Not a second messenger system. I apologize for that. That's actually different than something else. You're creating a signaling cascade through enzyme activity changes. So what happens is this, ladies and gentlemen, among other things, the RAS binds both GDAV phosphate and GTP. It's only active when what binds to it? What changes the GTP to the GDP or GDAP? The very site of the binding of the GTP has a low level of GTPase activity. It's like a timer. Okay? So as soon as the GTP binds, inevitably, because of activity of where it binds, it is dephosphorylated. It becomes GDAV phosphate. And when it becomes GDAV phosphate, the RAS activity becomes inactive. So the RAS protein or enzyme has its own turning off mechanism. It's like a timer. You go into a room. Some people's houses have room timers on their lights. You turn it on, and if you don't move in 10 minutes, it just automatically turns off. Well, that's what this is. It's a low level of GTPase activity that slowly hydrolyzes the GTP, and when it becomes GDAV-P, it turns it off. No, negative feedback is a multiple step of an enzyme pathway. One product is, this is actually kind of, I don't know how to describe it. It's like an internal timer.
Is it the cascading that makes it?
No. None of this has any effect on the activity of the GTPase activity. It's internal within the protein or enzyme. All right, so but what happens is it turns out that apparently this GTPase activity is relatively slow, and therefore the body has responded, whatever that means, by providing a second enzyme that helps speed it up. And that second enzyme is called GAPS, and that's called, GAPS stands for GTPase activating protein. The active RAS GDP complex begins the RAS signaling cascade. All right, so Once this thing is active in the interior of the cell, this RAS acts on other effectors. Notice there's a notice what this line says. It says that there's a kinase cascade. Now, what does a kinase do? Adds phosphate. Okay, so this thing then acts on a RAF protein, which acts on a MEK, which acts on a MAPK. These are other kinases. This eventually enters into the nucleus and begins to phosphate these various transcription factors. So I'm not sure what the RAF name is and what it means, but the MEK is has another name called a MAP kinase kinase. Yes?
Looking at the picture, too,
yeah.
You said that the active RAS GTP complex, is that the addition, like the combination of the two together then?
Right. In other words, the RAS is not active unless the GTP is bound to
so
it.
That's not talking about the RAS gap?
No. Okay. No, it is only the RAS GTP. The gap comes in at a later time or at a random time and helps hydrolyze that to turn it off. But the gap is not a part of the cascade. Okay, then you've got something known as MAP. Now, what is a MAP? Well, a MAP, the MAP is called a mitogen-activated protein. Mitogen-activated protein. So MEK can also be called a MAP kinase kinase. And the MAPK is a mitogen-acting protein kinase, also sometimes called ERKs, and I have no idea where it's called ERKs. FOS, JUN, and MIC are proteins that are known as eukaryotic transcription factors. And so you'll see here, if this is a protein, if this is a growth factor that's made out of a protein, it eventually comes in there and follows through a specific cascade of enzyme activities that eventually enter into the nucleus and begins a changing in the transcription activity of the nucleus, which would, of course, not surprisingly, probably stimulate growth. Errors in this process have a tendency to cause cancer. Because if errors in this process become uncontrolled, you have uncontrolled growth in the signaling going to the nucleus, which would mean you'd have uncontrolled growth of the cell, division, this kind of a thing, which of course is cancer. All right, so that means this, variants of these genes. I mean, what I mean by these genes, the genes that are producing these intermediates, any of these intermediates, variations of these genes that stimulate the growth of cancer are called oncogenes. You probably have heard that term before, but it's called oncogene. That's what these things do if there's a genetic problem. Notice, if you would, all the individual steps that could, in fact, if there's a genetic error, initiate cancer. Because, of course, this kinase cascade means that you're adding phosphates to each of the subsequent steps. If you're going to turn that whole process off, what do you have to have? Phosphatases that turn off this process. You don't want it always turned on. You need to turn it off. So there may be a kinase cascade. There's also going to be a phosphatase cascade. And if the phosphatase cascade is in error, so it can't turn it off, you have cancer there as well. A million ways to die. The necessary companion enzyme protein tyrosine phosphatases exist as cascade and are also highly regulated. Highly regulated. So both the turning on is highly regulated, the turning off is highly regulated. All these things here that are turned on are acting on other effectors that in fact come back and act on them. If you wonder why life is so complicated, well, it's because it's very complicated. All right. Now then, this is one of my favorite ones. Now, apparently, I have been using an older, maybe not. No, this has got to be right. Isn't this, does it say phosphatase? Yeah. It's the inositol phosphate process is a little different. Anyway, let's go ahead. Now, this is another signaling pathway. This is called the heterotrimeric G proteins. Heterotrimeric G proteins. It's a superfamily of GTPases responsible for signal transduction. Signal transduction. And let's see here, which is, and also vesicle trafficking, actin microfilament growth, and translation. Translation. And last one is protein. Is it protein targeting is the last one? Okay, let's take a look. Protein-coupled receptors include the glucagon receptor, and which many and many others, glucagon receptor and many others noted to have a 7TM morphology. 7TM morphology. The 7TM is called 7-transmembrane. This is a receptor that has 7 alpha helices that that pass through the membrane. All right, so they have 7 segments of these things that pass through the membrane between the outside and the inside, and they see a lot of the 7TM. Over 60% of the therapeutic drugs target G-protein-coupled receptors, called GPCRs. The receptors are subject to desensitization as well. So write in desensitization. And what else is at the bottom there? We've got a little bit more. On page 436, note the action of sildenafil. Sildenafil. So you need to read through that. You'll find that interesting if you haven't heard of it already. Now, so we're going to be taking a look. I want you to focus now. I did not go through a line-by-line designation as I did with the previous one. You're going to have to follow this along in the next 5 minutes. Okay? What happens is this. The G protein, the heterotrimeric G proteins, are this cluster right here, where you've got an alpha, a beta, and a gamma subunit. An alpha and a beta and a gamma subunit. In this case, the alpha subunit has an S in front of it, which means it's stimulatory. You can have other G, other parts, other members of that same trimeric family that would have an I in front of the alpha subunit, which would mean inhibitory. We'll find out what that means in a little bit. Please note that when the alpha, beta, and gamma subunit are physically associated next to the receptor, their activity is turned off. When they're physically associated as a trimer next to the receptor, they're physically turned off. Another clue that they're physically turned off is the presence of a bound GDP, bound GDP to the alpha subunit. So, the G proteins are turned off when they have a bound GDP and they're physically associated with each other. When an external stimulatory signal comes in and lands on the receptor changes its conformation. That conformation is passed through the membrane into the cytosol, interacts with that trimer. At that point, 2 things happen. The GDP is expelled and GTP is bound to that place, and there is a physical separation between the three subunits, in which the beta-gamma unit hangs together but physically separates from the alpha subunit. At the point that the alpha subunit is both physically separate and contains the GTP, that then becomes an active G protein. And in this case, this active G protein moves to activate an enzyme called AC, which stands for adenylate cyclase, which takes 4 ATPs, removes 4 pyrophosphates, and makes 4 cyclic AMPs. So the cyclic AMPs are, in fact, the second messenger in this system. The second messenger. The cyclic AMP is a small molecule. It disperses immediately into the cell and initiates a broad range of reactions. So the S alpha with its GTP bound positively stimulates the adenylate cyclase. It doesn't mean the adenylate cyclase has been off. It just means it may have been operating at some relatively low level. It's continually making these cyclic AMPs, but now it's been told to increase their production of the cyclic AMP. Now, how does this get turned off? Well, this alpha subunit is known as a GTPase. Guess what a GTPase does? Hydrolyzes GTP to what? GDAP. And so what happens here is, although it's difficult to parse this, it simply says that there's a low level of GTPase activity within the context and structure of this alpha subunit, so it will spontaneously and randomly turn off or create a GDP attachment. It'll just make a GDP right there by hydrolyzing one of the phosphates. As soon as that happens, guess what happens when it turns into a GDP? Exactly, that alpha subunit becomes inactive. It then physically moves and reassociates with the beta and gamma subunit and sits there and then physically associates with the receptor, ready to be activated again by the binding of another ligand. So it is the continual low level of GTPase activity that turns it off. Turns it off. Okay? Does this make sense? Everybody with me so far? Guess what in part the cholera toxin does? It inhibits the GTPase activity. Which means what? That alpha subunit is always turned, which means it makes huge excess amounts of... Yeah, and that's one of the mechanisms. So Haiti, the victims in Haiti... This is real life, ladies and gentlemen. The victims in Haiti, the bacterium that got overgrown in their gut because they drank contaminated water, produced a toxin. One of the mechanisms the toxin had was to... was inhibited this GTPase activity, which turned on the adenylate cyclase. And what happens there is the adenylate cyclase turns on the epithelial cells of the gut and they begin to pump enormous amounts of sodium into the lumen of the intestine. That creates a situation where the osmotic pressure is such that water moves from the gut into the intestinal tract, and they get these tremendous amounts of diarrhea containing huge amounts of the cholera toxin, but they die of electrolyte imbalance and dehydration. So what's the solution? Clean water with electrolytes. If they get them that, they live, because the body can handle the cholera toxin as long as you can survive the dehydration. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
The long and winding road that leads to your door will never disappear. I've seen that road before. To your door, the wild and windy night that the rain washed away has left a pool of tears crying for. Let me know the way. a long, long time ago.